Welcome to the Morning Glory Project, Stories of Determination. I'm your host, Betsy Graziani Fassbender. Like in nature, we see determined flowers and vines clinging to life and seeking light, so are Morning Glory people. And in this podcast, I'll interview writers, activists, artists, entrepreneurs, survivors and thrivers, and trailblazers of all kinds. These are folks that have been determined to get over, under, around, and through the obstacles that face them, or to seize the opportunities that come before them. I find these people inspiring and amazing. I know you will too. It's my pleasure today to welcome to the Morning Glory Project, Grace Livingston. She is on a journey to find her voice as a writer and storyteller as she faces illness, loss, and all the other tragically beautiful things that make us human. Grace works as a senior researcher for 10% Happier, a mindfulness meditation company where she's currently helping founder and ABC News anchor Dan Harris on his forthcoming book, codenamed 10% Nicer. Grace's background is in business operations and strategy, ranging from large public technology companies to small nonprofits. She's an active member of the Reimagine community, first as a volunteer and then as a performer and the host of multiple events for people personally facing illness at Reimagine NYC and SF. She lives in Mill Valley, California with her husband, Ben, and her pit bull, Hollyhock. Grace, welcome to the Morning Glory Project. I'm so happy that you're here.
Thanks so much, Betsy. It's great to meet you and great to be here.
For my listeners, I became aware of Grace when I attended an event that is addressed on another episode of this podcast called Reimagine. And Reimagine End of Life is an organization that is sort of getting us to look at end of life not as an end, but as a process and as an experience, as part of life, and to approach it creatively, differently, open-heartedly, I guess is how you'd say it. And I heard Grace speak, and she was so inspiring that I wanted you to meet her as well. So Grace, can you tell us a little bit about your life, say in 2017? How were things going?
Sure. So in 2017, I was living in San Francisco, and I had been living in San Francisco for the last, at that point, probably 6 or 7 years, started out my career in finance and transitioned into working at tech companies and was enjoying myself, but perhaps not quite as fulfilled as I might have been. In 2015, I lost my mom to cancer. And so I spent a year at home, both caring for her through her end of life and then caring for my grandparents, who are both approaching end of life at that moment also. And then as I returned to San Francisco in the timeframe that you're just talking about, 2016, 2017, I had had this massive shift in my life. My mom raised me as a single parent and I as her only child. And so the loss of her was really the loss of my whole nuclear family all at once. And so I took a significant amount of time to process that and to decide really when to come back to San Francisco, to come back to my fast-paced life, because I knew that my tendency would be to just keep moving forward, and I knew in some way that I needed to slow down in order to be able to grieve and really allow what had happened to sink in without going back to my life so quickly. So I spent a good amount of time in Ohio then. And around that time frame of 2017 is when I came back and started to sort of set up my life again. I was just in a new relationship with my now husband, Ben. We had just fallen in love in this really beautiful way. And so I was living pretty happily. I was, again, not super fulfilled work-wise, and was still sort of figuring out where I wanted to land and how I wanted to use, you know, the skills that I have to offer to the world.
You were how old at this stage?
I was 27 when my mom died, and so about 28 and a half.
Yeah. So you were where lots of people are in their late 20s, kind of, is this where I want to be? I'm not sure. It hasn't all quite started yet, but now I've found new love. And lots of that kind of swirl sounds like the late 20s. Not so typical, of course, to lose your mom so young and all of that. But the other parts of your life sound kind of typical for a late 20s something, right?
Typical and very privileged and very just, my life was beautiful and I'm so grateful for all of it. I had, you know, had, yeah, I haven't had, have always had a very beautiful life and full of love. And in that way, I think it's both typical and atypical. So I feel, you know, lucky in that way.
Right. And then in 2017, there was a proposal.
Yes, there was.
Tell us just a little bit about that.
Sure. So, so my partner and I, Ben, go to Burning Man every year. Or he's, you know, he started out and we went together for the first time, and it became a place where our love really sort of set and found its way. And, we discovered more and more about each other, when we went to Burning Man together. And so I decided to propose to Ben at Burning Man. And I did that partly because I'm a very unconventional person, and I had beforehand thought previously that marriage wasn't for me and had been very outspoken about that. And so the chances that Ben would ever propose to me were slim to none. So I'd made it very clear.
You already told him, no, it wasn't going to happen.
Yeah. But some part of me felt, especially after losing my mom, that it was really important to me that there was someone in my life and someone for, you know, in both directions who I could show up for when, or if things got hard, and vice versa. Because so my mom lived as a single woman for the majority of her life. And for most of her life, if she had had a partner at the time, my mom was gay. And so if she had had a partner at the time, that partner would not have been able to be her main point of contact in the hospital, if something had gone wrong when I wasn't around. And so it really, you know, that sort of practical, having someone who's able to be there for me and for whom I'm able to be there at the end of life was really important to me.
So it sounds like kind of three things: the love that you were discovering with Ben, the loss of your mom that acquainted you with her aloneness in a certain way, and also your awareness of end of life issues and wanting to have to be there for somebody or have someone be there for you. That the notion of commitment and the value of that kind of busted through some of your unconventional ways of looking at things.
It was not so much the her aloneness, but the way that our medical system doesn't honor same-sex relationships for the majority. We're getting better now that gay marriage is legal, but it was more that aspect where her partners would not have been allowed or able to be there for her in the ways that I was as her daughter at the end of life, if that had been.
Well, thank you for clarifying that. And that, of course, is a wrong that isn't completely over in our culture,
right,
but that is being corrected to some degree a little bit as we go. Not nearly enough and not nearly fast enough, but so just the awareness of all of those, like you say, the practicalities, as well as this beautiful love that you found with Ben. So you proposed, he said yes. And then 2018, tell us about that. What changed?
So 2018, early in the year in February, started out that I went on a trip to Ecuador. I was working with a nonprofit organization called Communitaire that does really amazing disaster relief work around the world. And I had some time on my hands because I had quit my job and decided to take some time off to work with projects that I felt more passionate about. So I took this trip and I came back and I was really sick. And I thought, oh, you know, I drank some water that was not bottled water, or I ate something that my stomach's not used to, but the symptoms continued for weeks and weeks, and got, you know, significantly worse. And I saw my doctor and they said, take an antibiotic, or you're bloated, or, you know, all these symptoms that seemed very hard to pin down. So I was, you know, I was having abdominal pain and just very things that can be symptomatic of almost anything, especially for women. But doctors weren't really sure what was going on. So I got a CT scan and they found a significant amount of ovarian cancer in my body. So I basically went from thinking I had, you know, drank some funny water in Ecuador to the knowledge that I had cancer all in a phone call one morning.
And it's not typical for a woman of your age at that time to instantly think cancer, of course.
Exactly.
It's much more likely that it's a bug that you drank bad water. And so no fault there, but, you know, so you discovered this. And so how did that, I mean, clearly, undeniably, a diagnosis of such a severe illness is going to change somebody's life. But tell us how it changed yours.
Oh, boy. Yeah. Pretty much all the ways. So, I mean, in the immediate sense, it changed my life because I had pretty massive surgery. It was the first time that I'd ever had surgery in my life. I'd never experienced any kind of illness before, other than minor things here and there. So, you know, I was spending time at the hospital a lot for the first few months. I did a big surgery and then a whole bunch of chemo up front, and have been in treatment pretty much ever since. It's ovarian cancer is an illness that, while is sometimes treatable, is not generally curable, which means that, you know, you can control it in some cases. But generally speaking, people look at ovarian cancer as sort of living with a long-term illness or a terminal illness, depending. And that's not always true. And we're making advances every day. I'm on a clinical trial right now of a new regimen that, you know, some doctors are pretty excited about. So one never knows. But it is a pretty substantive diagnosis, and it's one that we don't hear a lot about because it's a reasonably small number of women every year who are diagnosed. So my life changed a lot. You know, I was already at that point working only in a consultative way with a couple of nonprofits that are close to me. And so I continued to do that in a small, you know, very, very part-time way, but mostly I had to refocus my whole life on self-care and healing treatment. Yeah, exactly. And learning, how to take care of myself in this very different way than a 30-year-old is usually used to knowing how to.
So you had lost your mom, you had lost your grandparents, or were in the process of losing them by this point. Mm-hmm. And then you got married in the middle of all of these diagnoses. Tell me about that decision, I think that some people might think, oh gosh, you would put that on hold or you would wait. And the reason I'm asking about it is not because I think it's strange or odd or weird, mm-hmm. but because I think it's indicative of how you view illness and how you view end of life.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I appreciate that question a lot.
Yeah. What went into that decision?
Yeah. So I feel like my stock answer here is Burning Man, but it's actually true. The following year in 2018, after getting through the first almost year of treatment, we decided to go for it, to go back to Burning Man. I was doing pretty well. I was tolerating chemo really well. My body was pretty strong. And so we went back. And while we were there, Ben, just something came over him and he was like, hey, I think when we get home, we should just get married right now. Because we had been, you know, we were to some extent putting it off a little bit, waiting for my hair to grow back or treatment to be over or some magical thing to be in place that wasn't. And so he was like, you know what, like, screw that, let's just do it. And so we went home from Burning Man, and 4 days later we got married at the beach in San Francisco. And I wore a floor length green sequin dress, and we had flower crowns that our friends had all, we went to the flower market that morning and made flower crowns and all wore them, and invited no one, which is, Ben and I are both huge introverts, so that felt really right for us. We had our dear friend who officiated, our dog Holly came, and we had someone to take some pictures. And then that was that. It was very small and very beautiful. We wrote our vows, and afterwards we celebrated with a big meal at the old Clam House, which is a really old, lovely family restaurant in San Francisco. It was perfect.
So the decision, it sounds like, you know, Ben was kind of a seize the day kind of a guy, but it sounds as though also, you know, some people when facing cancer might say, you know, look, I don't want to put my partner through this. I don't want to get him stuck with this. Or he might think, oh, I might not want to sign in for that because it could get bad. But it sounds like the two of you, your commitment was already there. Mm-hmm. And this was about kind of formalizing it for both the emotional and the practical reasons, knowing that, and it sounds like also in 2018, you were sort of optimistic that this was, you were closing this off. Perhaps you didn't view it as an ongoing matter. Is that accurate or not?
I think that what the beginning of what you said, that being a seize the day person, and that sort of our approach to illness and things is very different. I think those two things are definitely true. And I think the, mm-hmm. what I would say the underlying feeling was, I want to do all the things that I want to do in life. And I don't know how long I have to do them. So I'll just start doing them.
There's kind of where I want to linger in our conversation, because I think that some people, when faced with an illness that could be terminal or could be, or it certainly is life-changing and mm-hmm. could be terminal, they start thinking, okay, what do I need to shave off? What do I need to stop doing? No, and I know that for a time when you're in treatment, of course, you have to do that because your focus has to be there. But it sounds as though you and perhaps Ben as well approach this with a, well, hey, if it's finite, let's get it all in. Mm-hmm. Let's do all the things that we want to do. Is that sort of your stance on this reimagining end of life and how you're viewing life and death and the process between those things?
Yeah, I mean, in many ways, it sounds really obvious, but the felt experience of it is just so much deeper, of just being the realization that, like, gut sense knowing that we only have a limited amount of time here. And that's always true. But when it's so front and center, it becomes really easy to feel it all the time. And while it doesn't stop me from, you know, watching a bunch of hours of Netflix or doing nothing for a whole day, or it doesn't mean that I'm constantly, like, out there doing all the life things because I only have, you know, got to do it all now. I only have 5 minutes. It doesn't feel like that necessarily, but just, yeah, my mom's death was the first death that I was really awake to. And it impacted me really significantly. I saw the limited nature of our existence just like that. And it really, it woke me up to, if there are things that I have maybe wanted to do, but have stopped myself for some reasons, cultural, personal, whatever they are, like, rethink that. And just, you know, I had been working in jobs, as I said before, that were great, and I was honored to do them, and they were interesting and meaningful work, but I didn't have that passionate connection to them. And that is another thing that's changed since cancer, is that I started working in the field that I love, and that's working with 10% Happier. Which is the meditation company that I work for now. Meditation has been a huge resource in my life, through not just cancer, but other really significant periods of challenge in my life. And so working to bring that to more people is what I get to spend my days doing now, which is beautiful.
You know, what strikes me, and this struck me when I was hearing you in your address to the festival where I attended, but also now, is that, you know, everybody's going to face an end of life. And we've, you know, there is even a film called The Bucket List, right? Mm-hmm. But most people face that in their older years. They, you know, that the average person doesn't start thinking bucket list stuff until they're, you know, of a certain age, whatever that phrase means. But that you got that bumped up, you know, into your late 20s and early 30s, here you were saying, okay, so, and I don't know that you use the term bucket list, but if you kind of said, well, you know, our time is finite. Now I'm intensely aware of that. So what are the things that I want to do? How do I want to find meaning? How do, you know, what's important to me? How do I want to live?
Yeah.
It sounds like that's kind of the shift that happened for you at a young age, as opposed to in your 50s or 60s or 70s.
Absolutely. And I think it's interesting because I had always associated bucket list with these huge things, right? Like riding in a hot air balloon, jumping off a cliff, going to Tanzania, like just these huge things. But what I've found, and some of those I still hold, and there are places that I would love to travel and crazy things that I would love to do. But my bucket list items, so to speak, lately have been things like, I sat my first week-long meditation retreat last year, 2 years ago. I've since been on three, and I'm doing a month-long retreat this March. I love it. It's a place where I find immense strength in myself, and also creativity and curiosity, and all these things that just feel so good. And they don't always have to be these big, crazy things, but they can be spending more time outside, or I would really like to, we got a dog right after my diagnosis. We hadn't had a dog and really, really wanted to have a dog. And so a month after I was done with surgery, we got a dog.
So Grace, can you tell me about 10% Happier?
Sure. So 10% Happier is a company that offers right now a meditation platform, an app that helps learn how to meditate. It was started by a number of amazing humans, one of whom is named Dan Harris, who's an ABC News anchor. You might know him from Good Morning America or Nightline. And he, a number of years ago, found meditation as a solution or a way of working with panic disorder. He had a panic attack during a live recording of Good Morning America, and it sort of jolted him awake of like, I need to find strategies that can help me cope with this. And meditation was it. He was very skeptical. The company was originally called 10% Happier Meditation for Fidgety Skeptics. And that's really sort of the underlying feeling, is some folks are a little bit allergic to some of the language around spiritual practice, or they're not comfortable yet with language around meditation or around Eastern or non-dual religions or religion at all. And so finding ways of bringing mindfulness to those who may have written it off as woo-woo or not for me for whatever reason. And it's a really amazing, absolutely amazing company and team and resource. And I can't recommend it highly enough. The app itself offers teachers that are from all walks of life. And that to me is different than a lot of other ways to practice meditation with an app. Generally, you have one person's voice and or just music or whatever. But this is getting to work almost feels like one-on-one with teachers from around the world and the pioneers of insight meditation, Sharon Salzberg, Joseph Goldstein, Sebne Selassie, all these amazing, amazing teachers.
Oh, wonderful.
You can tell based on my proliferation of words there that I feel really passionately about 10% Happier. I could go on for days.
Well, who doesn't, first of all, it's a great title. Who doesn't want to be at least 10% happier? Come on. I mean, that's a great title, but it's also, it sounds like for you also, I'm kind of wrestling in my mind here, Grace, between two kinds of questions. One is the kind of mom in me. It's like, okay, what's the state of your health? How are things? What's the prognosis? What's the, you know, have they given you a timeline? All of those kinds mm-hmm. of practical, I think, earthly kinds of questions. And then there's this other part of me that wants to go completely differently and say, so how do you, what do you do? 10% of happiness and meditation is one thing. What else do you do that helps you look at end of life more wholly? How do you fight your fear? How does that happen for you?
Well, let me spend maybe 2 minutes on the down to earth, what's happening parts. It might be helpful to understand the rest of, and then I would love to dive into your second questions. Those are beautiful. So right now, I mentioned earlier that I'm on a clinical trial. It's a hormone therapy, which is, I never know where to start with answering this question, but I'm on a treatment right now that's exciting, but the outcome of it is generally assumed to be slowing down the growth of the cancer or potentially stopping the growth of the cancer. That would be like a great outcome.
Right.
But that said, reversing the course that has already been taken, sort of getting rid of the cancer that's already there is not a likely outcome for this drug. And so, you know, the word terminal is kind of has a lot of weight and a lot of sort of drama behind it. So I don't use it that often, but my assumption is that this disease will end my life at some point. It is very unclear when that will be. And it's honestly pretty unclear how it will happen right now based on where I'm sitting, because I'm pretty young, and the average age for ovarian cancer is 63 to 65 years old. And so a lot of the statistics around prognosis and things are based on that number. And so I don't really find them very helpful to think about or look at. But you know, my day-to-day knowledge is that this is an illness that unless something, you know, I believe fully in the universe will do what it will. And we don't know everything. Hardly, we know nothing really about what's really going on from like a systems level, but so who knows? But based on what I know now about the drug that I'm on and the way that this disease generally progresses, it will probably end my life. Yeah. Hmm.
And you just live with that, knowing that.
I do. I do. The thing that helps me the most, I would say, and to dovetail into your second set of questions, the thing that helps me the most is the lesson that I learned from my mom, and I will start crying very soon, just as a heads up.
That's if
I
okay. We allow shaky. That.
Yeah. Is the lesson that I learned from my mom during the end of her life, which was, to do what feels right to my body and don't worry about what the rest of the world tells me about fighting or pushing through or battling, or when just listening to my body and making decisions that honor my body, which is a very different approach than what we get a lot of times in Western medicine, which is attack the disease, fight it, kill it, win. It's just a very different sort of framework. My mom, when in her journey with cancer, found the cancer in time to attempt surgery and attempt treatment, but it had spread too far to do chemotherapy or radiation. And so she decided to use palliative care and hospice very early on compared to what most people do. She knew that time in hospitals was not how she wanted to spend her time. She wanted to spend her time at home. And so she made that happen. We made that happen together. And her end of life, her actual last moments of life were beautiful and present and reasonably clear-headed, honestly. And we were together, and that goal of that kind of an end of life where it's full of love and connection and peace is the thing that helps me the most in my day-to-day life when I remember the things that are scary. When I remember, like, oh yeah, this life may be short, and I may be gone soon. That I remember that it doesn't have to be, the actual process doesn't have to be scary, and it doesn't have to be sad, and it can be sad, but it doesn't have to be all sad, and it certainly doesn't have to be full of fear, which I think is what can naturally arise when we think about the unknown.
Sounds like your mom gave you important lessons up until the last second she was here and continues to even now.
Oh, she truly does. Yeah.
That's a beautiful lesson that I think I'm going to take from our conversation today, Grace, that to honor oneself in the process and not be pressured to adhere to another person's expectation or societies or medicines or whatever it is. That doesn't mean you reject it all medical care. I don't mean that. Mm-hmm. But it sounds like your mom took ownership of her own process and that you're doing that as well. It's very inspiring and very touching as well. I, of course, wish you every benefit of medicine and meditation and whatever other mechanisms that nurture you, body, mind, and spirit. And I wish you wonderful, long recovery in the process as well. Or if it's short, that it be meaningful and that you have the kind of experience that you want. I want to share with our listeners then, remind them that there's the 10% happiness app, which, by the way, I'm going to be checking out right after this call, because that sounds like something that could benefit any of us. We all have terminal illnesses, right?
Yeah, we certainly do.
whether we know it or not, this is a finite thing. And however we want to live, I think it can be made more meaningful by examining internally as well as out in the world. And even if it does mean lingering around and watching a little Netflix now and then. So Grace, thank you so much for being on the Morning Glory Project today and for being such an inspiring and amazing person. I'm so happy that my path crossed yours, and I hope that it will continue to do so.
Me too. Thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure, and I really appreciate it.
My conversation with Grace Livingston left me with a few extra blooms today. One is the lesson, of course, that her mom taught her, which was that in her own end-of-life choices and process and dealing with disease, that she honored what she wanted to do. She listened to her own body and chose the path that she wanted to. And I so believe in our right to do that. And it's amazing that her mom gave her that lesson. I'm also touched by how on virtually every question, Grace was able to sort of toggle between the practical and the, I don't know what you'd call it, spiritual or other than practical, that they're the practical reasons for getting married and the emotional ones, that there are the practical decisions around end of life and the laws and the procedures of those things, and then there's one's relationship to it. But I think that the biggest extra bloom for me is her approach to what I called, and she didn't call, the bucket list, which is that it's not just about the big things. It's about living your life in a meaningful way. It's about spending time the way that you want to spend it with the people and even the four-legged creatures that you want to spend it with. Given that we all have a terminal illness in this world, that we're, what's the old expression? None of us get out of here alive. Given that that's the truth for us, I wonder if whether or not we've ever been diagnosed with a problem, if we can each live each day of our own design, if we can put our eyes where we want them to be with whom we want to be, spend our time the way we want to spend it. That's a pretty nice extra bloom. Thanks for listening to the Morning Glory Project today. I know that you have lots of demands for your time, and I'm honored that you'd spend a little bit of it here listening to these stories. If you've enjoyed this story or another, don't hesitate to give us a 5-star on your review. That helps us get listeners and other good things. And beyond that, go out and bloom.